Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Almost a year after the devastation and massive government failings in Hurricane Katrina, all Americans remember the great catastrophe, but African Americans think about it more. A new poll finds 18% of whites say they think about Katrina often. Among blacks, that number is 40%. The storm, the death, the unveiled abject poverty, the faces of black Americans left to suffer in the midst of calamity while luxury buses whisked whites out of town. A new collection of essays by black thinkers calls Katrina the most profound spectacle of cumulative black disadvantage in a generation. Up next on Point, after the storm, black Americans look at the meaning of Katrina. In a moment, we'll speak with the editor and contributors to the new book, After the Storm. But first, we turn to New Orleans for an update on what's recovering there and what's not. Joining me now is Jed Horn, Metro editor at the Pulitzer Prize-winning New Orleans Times-Picayune. His new book is Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City. Jed Horn, thanks very much for joining us.
Tom, it's a privilege to be with you.
Jed, I see an essay of yours recently where you talk about you and your family considering leaving New Orleans. What have you decided? And almost a year on, who's left, who's come back, and who hasn't?
Well, the situation here is very much in play. I would say we're on the cusp, we're on the bubble. I will almost certainly stick around, but an awful lot of people who had the misfortune to be driven out of the city, my house did not flood, so I've been able to live here, are reassessing, are in a kind of limbo, and wondering exactly what to do next.
You had a population in New Orleans of about 450,000 people. What is it now? And we're talking about race in this hour. How has the complexion of New Orleans changed in this year?
The best numbers we're able to put our hands on show a return population at best half what it was prior to the storm. And because a disproportionate part of the people who were forced out of the city were African American, there has been a corresponding reduction, I think, in the proportion of citizens who are African American. New Orleans remains, nonetheless, as one hopes it always will, an African American city by majority.
Remind us of, again, along color lines, who got hit by this storm?
Well, there were people hit in all demographic categories, including very rich, very white folk. But the areas that were most seriously clobbered, the fabled Lower Ninth Ward and parts of New Orleans East, later settled in the history of the city, were settled by African Americans, home ownership being a privilege and an opportunity that came late to that group. So they were hit worse, and those areas have been slowest to revive.
The evacuees scattered around the country, where are they now?
Well, they remain, I'm sure, a representation throughout the country, and there are people who are digging in, sinking roots in these new communities, and this is a cause of great concern here. I would say, though, that the bulk of the people have returned at least to the perimeter of the damaged city and are living in the suburbs or living within commuting distance of the city. And our hope is that the numbers, which so far are way off at half the population prior to the storm, in fact, don't capture the fact that people have committed emotionally and politically to the city but aren't yet within the parish boundaries that define New Orleans.
In big terms, I'm sure we'll talk more about this as the anniversary approaches, but how is the revival of New Orleans going? What's being rebuilt and what's not?
Well, what's not being rebuilt is altogether too much of what was damaged. The federal response at the recovery phase has been as slow as the immediate rescue was, and that, of course, was notoriously inadequate and lethal to lives lost due to the failure by FEMA to get folks back in here quickly with buses and rescue operations. What we're seeing is about $8 billion wending its way from Washington to New Orleans, a substantial sum of money, a generous sum of money in terms of a city of this size. But it's shocking and extremely destructive of the city's morale that money has yet to reach here.
And the city that's envisioned in the rebuilding, there's a lot of talk about New Orleans. You called it an African-American city and said that it will continue to be so, but will that really be evident in its population? Or, you know, the word that's been put out there is that this is going to be a Disney version, a white affluent population, many of the blacks gone, and if it's African-American, you know, in the music, in the clubs, in the kind of entertainment face New Orleans puts to the world, but not necessarily in its population. What do you say?
Well, that's a legitimate concern. I would correct you in your assumption that people of means in this town are necessarily white. There are plenty of middle class and upper middle class African Americans. This is a city that has had free people of color since before the Civil War, and many of them are very accomplished in business and the professions. The danger is that we lose our middle our working class, because there is a huge spike in property values here in the part of the city that survived, and as a result, rents are shooting up, and all the forces of the market are at play in ways that are harmful to the working poor, who are badly needed to sustain the culture and also simply the tourism economy, if you will, that has been central to New Orleans as we've known and loved it.
Jed, Mayor Ray Nagin famously or infamously talked about maintaining New Orleans as a chocolate city. How's that gone down with residents of New Orleans? And is the racial profile of the city a public conversation there?
Yeah, race is no secret in New Orleans. Neither is poverty, although poverty and class have probably been the less well-rehearsed parts of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Nagin's remarks were dismaying, I think, initially to a lot of people, in particular African-Americans, as well as people involved in the convention business and others who saw them as off-putting. I think as the election returns suggested, and Nagin was able to get reelected, all was forgiven in that regard, and the hope was that Nagin would overcome some of his political oafishness and make the difficult decisions that are needed in order to get the planning process and the recovery process more fully underway.
And Jed, finally, you've been weighing whether to stay or go for you and for others. What's going to make the difference, whether you or not you become long-term residents of New Orleans?
Well, I am a long-term resident.
Or remain, I should say.
Living here for 20 years
yeah.
now. But what it comes down to is competency. If we see the kind of direction that is required in this situation, we have a sort of a neocon of a mayor who is kind of loosey-goosey when it comes to recovery strategies. If they don't seem to work, if people, in fact, are pulling out, if the Army Corps does not adequately commit to defend this city against the kinds of flood threats and storm threats that we face, hardcore people like myself may stick around, but you're going to see people running for the exits. And one terrible storm here is all it would take this season to convince people that we did not have the commitment that we need in order to rebuild the city that is, after all, at the mouth of the major waterway on this continent.
Jed, it's great talking with you. I hope we speak with you again. Good luck and hang in there.
Thanks so much.
Jed Horn joined us from New Orleans. He's Metro Editor for the Times-Picayune and author of Breach of Faith, Hurricane Katrina, and the Near Death of a Great American City. Now we go directly to the color line through this great storm. Joining me from New York is David Dante Trout. He's professor of law at Rutgers University and editor of a new collection of essays, After the Storm, Black Intellectuals Explore the Meaning of Hurricane Katrina. David Dante Trout, thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
You write at the outset in this book that it revealed a generation's single most profound spectacle of cumulative black disadvantage. Is that your number one takeaway from Katrina?
Yeah, that's the number one takeaway, because I think there's an almost primordial sense of horror watching the tragedy unfold. I think obviously for the folks who are living it, but for all of us around the country. And what made that spectacle so horrible, despite all the terrible disasters that most of us living in the United States have witnessed, at least from afar for many years, was the sense that this was impacting black people in a very special and horrific way that could only be reminiscent of slavery, and didn't, you know, you don't want to necessarily go. Yeah, I don't mean to sound melodramatic, but I think Jesse Jackson, as quoted in Michael Eric Dyson's essay in the book has a quote about watching family members outside the Superdome, their anguished faces screaming, looking, where is my father, where is my mother, where is my child, where is my child? And this sense that we have been here before in the very worst aspect of our history, you know, namely during the Middle Passage. So it begins there, if you will. And then when you think about the experience of African Americans in this country, we almost all started poor. I mean, it's kind of funny to think about that. It's a, sort of a demographic category today. But our history in this country is to begin poor, and obviously many of us have gone well beyond that. But when you looked at the population who was most in need, floating as bloated corpses down streets, trying to get on buses, living in fetid conditions, wondering where each other was and what was going to happen to them, you were struck by this sort of original position of poverty and despair. And you realize that over hundreds of years of being in this nation, for this spectacle to play out, you were looking at the accumulation of disadvantages that have, for a significant a segment of the black population, continued apace, notwithstanding all the terrific gains that we've made.
David, in New York, I mean, we saw the images from the centers there where people were really in terrible distress. We also saw people of all races hit by this. I mean, white people's homes got creamed. Black people's homes got creamed. In a very powerful foreword to this collection, Derek Bell writes that for black people, the deadly drama of the experience marked an official close to civil rights era dreams of equality, of opportunity. That is a gigantic statement coming out of one storm. Interpret it for us.
Well, I think it sort of goes back to the magnitude of this spectacle. You know, there are, it's I think it's probably fair to say, without oversimplifying, that there are two sets of victims here. There are two ways to think both about the tragedy as well as the recovery. And without answering for Derek, but certainly because some of that is in my essay as well, if you focus on the second, if you focus, and I mean second in the sense that they are secondary, if you focus on the people whom we saw in the greatest distress, that is persistently poor people without the means to escape this terrible flood for a variety of reasons, but almost all of which go to their scarce command of resources, you cannot help but be struck by how so many of the institutional mechanisms that we have fought for in this country to address inequality have failed. And within the legal community, both practicing lawyers and legal scholars have for at least 25 or 30 years, led in part by the insights of people like Derek Bell, questioned the effectiveness of civil rights remedies in reaching to populations of blacks who are persistently poor and who right now live in the conditions made possible by a variety of forms of residential organization in this country.
So when you look at the meaning, you stretch
facilitated middle class life.
You stretch the meaning right beyond the Gulf Coast and New Orleans, and right across the country to urban centers in particular.
Well, yeah, because what of course was revealed by Katrina was the tremendous vulnerability of a forgotten and often despised population living in cities. And even though the poverty rate, the schools, the murder rate in New Orleans were exceptional in how terrible they all were, they were not incomparable to what you see in, well, I don't want to start offending cities, but what you start seeing if you look at the same indices in at least 25 other cities in this country. So persistent urban poverty in New Orleans has some peculiar traits to New Orleans, but in many, many of its most important aspects, it is very similar to what you see in other cities. And what you don't see in those cities is the sort of sudden death of communities as a result of something as devastating as Katrina. But let's not pretend that were the storm to ride through Chicago or parts of New York or parts of Oakland, California, tomorrow we would see a similar spectacle of cumulative disadvantage and start questioning whether or not our civil rights strategies could reach those populations effectively.
A lot of big dots and more than dots being connected here. David Dante-Trau, please stand by. I want to turn to Baton Rouge, where one of your essayists is standing by to join us. John Valery White is with us. He's professor of law at Louisiana State University, author of the essay, The Persistence of Race Politics and the Restraint of Recovery in Katrina's Wake. John Valery White, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi.
So we just heard at the top of this hour from Times-Picayune's Metro editor about what's happening and what's not in the recovery phase here. How do you interpret what's... Well, let's look at the aftermath first this time. What's gone on in the year since Katrina? Is there still a racial message in the recovery path?
Well, I think the recovery has taken place in a halting and then rapidly moving fashion. And the racial message has become more or less submerged in the effort to try and get the city back on its feet. I think that in my essay, I suggest that a rapid recovery to New Orleans is somewhat limited by kind of structural racial politics, and that that structural racial politics is much less evident than the kind of symbolic discussion that Katrina has generated. So the racial politics that has structured recovery is still in play, but it's not something that is on the surface of people's discussion. And I think that that animates the desire on many people's part to have race be a topic of discussion.
Well, take us into that with, for example, with the reelection of Ray Nagin, black mayor of New Orleans. What does that say or what does it not say about the racial politics, as you have it, of the city?
Well, I read the reelection as a backlash against the new New Orleans message. I think Mayor Nagin was very effective at sort of finding a middle ground between the new New Orleans message and himself as a sort of speaker for the black city.
What's the new New Orleans message?
Well, the new New Orleans message was that New Orleans would be a brighter, cleaner, more successful, less poor place with great schools, etc. And I think that that message was read by many, many people as a much, much less black city, a city that would be minority black rather than the overwhelming majority black population it had before, and that those are tied with notions of poverty, that the city would be less poor, and so in particular its poor black population would not be there. And I think many black voters, I think at the time of the election, the population of black voters was still a slight majority, read that discussion as an indictment against them personally, even people who are not themselves poor. Sort of floated toward Nagin in the election. He essentially recreated his initial coalition of business interests and poor blacks against the support of those who wanted a new New Orleans and the overt campaign of his opponent for that.
And do you believe that New Orleans is now on path to be that whiter city that you describe? And if so, what's the significance?
No, not necessarily. It's not clear what New Orleans is going to look like in the next 5 or even 10 years. I think that the recovery is promising in many respects. I mean, the unflooded parts of the city have very few markers that a hurricane came through. And many of the parts that were lightly flooded are being rebuilt pretty rapidly given the tremendous housing demand in the region. So it's just not clear who's going to move back to the city, but it is true that that poor people are having lots of problems moving back to the city because of the housing shortage. And that's a problem both for them when they desire to come back to the city, but also for the city itself, because the city has always been dependent on low-income or low-wage workers, rather.
David Dante-Trout, let me turn to you on this. You write that New Orleans must not be permitted to be Americanized, the Americanization of a black city. And by that, I guess you mean the ghettoization, or I don't know if you mean the lightening of the complexion. But yet, you and others go after Ray Nagin for saying New Orleans will be a chocolate city again. What are your expectations? What's the difference between trying to maintain New Orleans as a strong African-American city and what Ray Nagin said or is saying?
Well, I think I would probably take a page out of Adolf Reed's essay, where he challenges the effectiveness of talking about any of the myriad problems associated with New Orleans before Katrina and afterwards through the language of race. And that may seem odd from the editor of an anthology like this, but I think we can talk about race almost too much to a certain extent and miss some very important aspects of sound urban planning, the development of a social contract that is inclusive and creates political and economic and social stability for all of its members.
But when you say the storm cannot be permitted to facilitate the Americanization of a black city, what do you mean?
Well, the Americanization reference is actually a reference to its use by an historian in New Orleans. But so it goes both to the Americanization of cities generally and also to the process of Creoles splitting and identifying in different racial ways in New Orleans in particular. But the Americanization as a general term is the bifurcation of the city into wanted and unwanted spaces. And the wanted spaces facilitate middle class life, and they're predominantly white. And the unwanted spaces or ghettos help to sustain poverty, actually, and also feature all of those undesirable elements that people don't want in a middle-class community. So if the recovery now focuses on creating this Americanized city, this city in which the poor are invisible, they're segregated, they're in small, isolated areas with concentrated poverty, with bad services, they can't get out, there's high crime, they're featured in the news in all sorts of terrible ways, and we think of them as miscreants and not worth much more than incarceration, then we have a real problem. Now, that was happening, obviously, in New Orleans. It could happen now in earnest. What you hope is that coming out of Katrina with all of this money and all of this opportunity to do real community planning, that you can remedy some of those terrible effects of decades of Americanization in New Orleans and serve as a model for other cities that have it as well. Mm.
David Dante Trout, John Valerie White, I want to turn to our listeners a lot. Want to join us. Joseph is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
I agree with your guess somewhat, and I think that, blacks are prepared to be wiped out by natural disasters. It taught us the reality of life, that disaster, Katrina, because this is an untoward generation. I mean, because of accumulated disadvantages of blacks, there is an inability to rebound from the disaster,
So what's the lesson to be taken away, Joseph, beyond that kind of, that horrible realization, if that's the one, that the vulnerability stands there?
What's the lesson?
What's the lesson looking forward out of that, then?
Well, the lesson looking forward is for all Americans to put their input into our government. Give the government their true feelings toward a disaster for anyone that has happened to and that experienced this type of thing in America. We have to have we can't have a false balance here in America. We got to have a just weight. We got to have a equal balance. Justice is blind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You got to have a even scale there,
Don't leave one segment so vulnerable, and we saw what happened there. Joseph, thanks for your call. John Valerie White, Kanye West, the pop singer, famously said, after what we saw in Katrina and the long, long wait for relief there, you said George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Mm-hmm.
What is the political message out of what happened there? And in this recovery period, if we can call it that, are the same old politics playing out or something new?
Well, I think that one of the things that the West statement highlights for me is the degree to which we are enamored with these kinds of broad symbolic statements. Racial politics is sort of a fact of life in the South for many, many years, but it doesn't necessarily manifest itself in terms of racist views or racialized thinking in an overt kind of way, but rather particular politicians are forced to try and balance what they think their constituents would respond to. And I think in some respects, what is still ongoing in Louisiana, and for that matter in many other parts of the country, is the sort of limitations that a racial lens has put on the prospects for political action. What I suggest is that in response to Katrina, the major issue of housing redevelopment has been substantially hampered by the way in which people are concerned about the racial reactions that constituents may have.
How so? How?
Well, I think in the region around New Orleans, where white flight has predominated and been the major development pattern for the last 20 or 30 years, one would expect there to be temporary housing in maybe not in large villages, but in small villages of trailers or other sorts of temporary facilities that would allow workers into the city. And in the region immediately adjacent to New Orleans in the north, there are none. And the nearest place that you find those kinds of developments are almost in Baton Rouge, which is quite a way away, over an hour commute, even more given the traffic problems that have developed as more people have commuted from Baton Rouge. So those kinds of decisions are decisions that, if you were thinking about them in the abstract, you might think, surely 40 miles away we would have these houses that workers could live in and commute into the city effectively. But since they don't exist, you have to ask why not. And it's a calculation that people are making about the likely response of folk in those regions.
But you say don't use a racial lens to look at this. So what does that mean? Just think of good public policy? Can you look at it without a racial lens?
Well, I think that's the nub, is that it highlights that we still have a very much a racial kind of political structure. But I also agree with Professor Reed, who suggests in his essay that necessarily having that conversation about race that Kanye West suggests is not necessarily as productive as trying to expose and then overcome these kinds of political restrictions that relate to a different kind of structural racial politics.
I want to turn to Cheryl Harris now. She joins us from Los Angeles, co-author of the essay in the book Loot or Find, Fact or Frame. She's professor of law at UCLA. Cheryl Harris, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You spent a lot of time looking at the news images that came out of New Orleans, and maybe that continued to come out. Loot or find, fact or frame, what are you going at?
I was trying to look at, Tom, the way in which Katrina seemed to initially at least challenge a prevailing view, a sort of dominant understanding about race in the United States, that race really doesn't matter, and racism is somewhat really a thing of the past.
That we're over that.
And that we're over that. That was then, and this is now. And it seemed that, at least initially, I think the overwhelming nature of the images coming out of New Orleans clearly challenged that colorblind view. But I think that in many disturbing kinds of ways, the prevailing kinds of racial frameworks that we have, the lens to some extent through which we see things, very much reasserted itself in the wake of the storm, so to speak, and reset our views in ways that did not, in fact, take advantage of the opening that the tragedy presented.
Now, you're talking there about the images described as looting. Of course, looting did go on, but the way it was portrayed, what? Are you saying, like David Dante Trout says, you know, it took us back to a sort of sense of slavery. We had calamity, and within seemed like minutes, the images were, you know, black people making trouble?
Yes, I think that part of what happened was that those images that initially came out of the city invoked a great deal of empathy. I think the record shows that there was an overwhelming response to the tragedy just at the average, at the level of average day Americans sending in money, trying to figure out what they could to aid the relief effort.
That in response to the images of suffering, the Superdome,
right,
and the rest.
That's right, but in a matter of days, what had reasserted itself was really a sense of chaos, black criminality, and lawlessness that required the strong hand of the law. And instead of what should have been a framework of rescue, we got a framework of occupation. And that very much, I think, exacerbated the tragedy.
Did that take us back, or did it just reveal what was already simmering along? How do you see it?
I see it as very much a reversion to a pre-existing framework. I used the debate about the two very famous photographs that appeared on the wires one which was characterized, in which a white couple was characterized as finding food, and the other in which a black man was characterized as looting, as a way of exploring how that framework reasserted itself very quickly. And I want to make clear that it's not my point to contest whether or not the photographers were technically accurate in describing what they saw. In fact, the photographers gave some extensive explanations as to why they came to the conclusion that to use, there were two different photographers, two different photographs, why they used the terms that they did. My point was is that even without any headings at all, those pictures would have been likely been understood in that way. That is, the pre-existing framework in which blackness is very much associated with lawlessness and criminality, and was a particular feature, I might add, of New Orleans.
A kind of an uncomfortable wake-up call here. Cheryl Harris, I want to invite our listeners in again. Greg's calling from New Orleans. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Thank you. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Greg? What do you think?
Well, what I see in the aftermath of a lot of this speaking is that there's a gross failure for people to really analyze New Orleans as it goes back, not just to Katrina or since Katrina, but understand that the city has had people, black people in leadership positions, black mayors, predominantly black council, predominantly black school boards, and in many other positions for the past 20 years.
And what do you take from that? If there was a problem when Katrina hit, it was the fault of black leaders?
Well, no one is bringing that issue up. And the fact of the matter is that the city has been in a continuous state of decline. And I actually moved back into New Orleans having lived in the suburb because I like the city. It's a great place.
But we get the charge.
But no one is holding these people accountable for their lack of leadership.
Let me put that to John Valerie White. John, here's your specialty. Greg says, come on, it was led by black leaders. If there was a problem, look home.
Yeah, I think in my essay I suggest that there's some substantial limitations on what on the effectiveness of black leaders to really represent the sort of entrenched poverty in these cities. It's not to forgive them of incompetent management where that might be appropriate, but nor is it to suggest that that their leadership is not to blame for not addressing those problems. I mean, when you're in a position of leadership, you're responsible for trying to fix the difficulties there. And the difficulty in New Orleans in particular has been the long decline of the city has accompanied black leadership, and black leadership has neither done much about the decline of the city nor addressed the particular position of poor blacks in the city. And I think that the caller is definitely correct about that aspect of the difficulty. My suggestion is that the commitments that black leaders are forced to make in this context should suggest to us that there's some limitations to this kind of analysis of black politics.
Nobody gets off the hook here, but check out the bigger picture. You say Phil's calling from Winooski, Vermont. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you feeling today? I have a few points. I hope I can make them all. The situation, it's a year gone by. Like a lot of things, after a year, people start just forgetting about it. And I think that's happening. The next hurricane will remind everyone. But I think the situation was shocking but not surprising. I think it was an intentional, racist, and class-based attack on the people of New Orleans.
Intentional.
The hurricane would come. The dikes wouldn't hold. They didn't do a thing about it. The immediate response was criminal, and to characterize people who are starving as looters, as was just mentioned before, is just terrible, just disgusting. The rebuilding status to be done in more affluent areas really tells the whole thing. And this John before was talking to the people in charge. That is Washington, I assume, is what he meant.
Mm. David Dante Trout, how about it? Phil describes intentionality to what happened in the immediate aftermath and maybe longer term.
I got to invent a word in my essay. I was very surprised that nobody caught it. I call it blunderous, the blunderous response of so many officials at the local, state, and federal level.
Does that suggest innocence?
No, it's I guess I'm going to have to define the denotation and send it off to Webster's, but it's got to mean something like a criminal negligence standard. I wouldn't go so far as to call it intentional. And frankly, I don't know. I think it'll be difficult for any of us to know, and I'm not sure that the inquiry will be terribly productive. But I do think that the caller is right to be outraged and to continue to be outraged by just the despicable incompetence that that helped to destroy so many lives in ways that really cannot yet be quantified. I mean, we just don't know what happens, for instance, to those children who were separated for so long and what the long-term effects may be.
Right. Cheryl?
Yeah, I'm sorry to
not at all
jump in. I think that to some extent, the question of the specific intent of individual actors is really not the point. The point is rather that, as the Times-Picayune had had in its papers 2 years before this event happened, that this was likely to happen and what the likely outcome would be. In other words, this was not a secret. This was not something that was unexpected, nor was it unexpected that if a major hurricane hit, that the levees would likely not hold. This was something that was known by many different levels of government. And the fact that over 100,000 people would have no means to evacuate themselves was also well known.
And yet it came. David, you say that ultimately the memory of this disaster itself will be erased. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's evident to some extent already in the poll that you cited at the top of the show, that 40% of black people polled are saying Katrina's on their mind and only 18% of white people are. I think there's a risk, frankly, that as we as black intellectuals try to contribute to the discourse and to the historical accounting of this tragedy, that our own views will be ghettoized, that we will be seen as sort of representing the black perspective on a black tragedy rather than representing some very well thought out critiques and prescriptions on an American tragedy from which we can all learn.
Well, we're trying to listen to it in just that way today. We're grateful to you for the book and the contributions and for being with us this hour. John Valerie White in Baton Rouge, professor at Louisiana State University. Mr. White, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Cheryl Harris at UCLA, co-author of Loot or Find, Fact or Frame. Cheryl Harris, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And David Dante Trout, professor of law at Rutgers, editor of After the Storm, Black Intellectuals Explore the Meaning of Hurricane Katrina. Mr. Trout, thank you for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.